From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. On this week's show, there's still no concrete plan from Google Fiber, but another group in Kansas City, Kansas, is thinking about how to use it to get people connected.
If this is going to really impact our community, we want to make sure that everybody has a chance to benefit from it.
We head to the fields and hear about how organized sports affect social development for youth.
And this is about the age when the coaches start getting stern with them and getting that tough voice with them and get a little tougher than, well, it's okay, you tried hard and that's good enough.
A domestic violence shelter begins housing women and their pets.
Plus a new album of classical piano from Park University student Behzad Abdurahimov. Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
Google has promised Kansas City speed of light internet. The potential for residents, businesses, schools, and hospitals, we've been told, is enormous. But in the years since the Google Fiber project was announced, we've heard very few concrete ideas for how to take advantage of the superfast network. Now, the founders of a new organization called Connecting for Good have a proposal to provide internet access to people who aren't connected at all. They want to start by building a low or no-cost wireless network on top of Google Fiber in Rosedale, Kansas City, Kansas. Connecting for Good co-founder Michael Limita is here to explain. So I'm curious, what interested you in starting the organization Connecting for Good? Had you heard about the Google Fiber project yet?
Well, it actually came about because I work as a consultant with nonprofits. And I had some partners who are in the technology realm who service local nonprofits. And so we began more or less last summer to talk about, you know, how could we do some training and seminars and things like that to help nonprofits have a better understanding of technology. And as we began, you know, just meeting around that, all of the announcements of Google Fiber came around and shifted our attention to this wonderful opportunity that we have before us now.
What was your first thought when you heard about this idea of the gigabit internet coming to Kansas City?
Well, I've been an internet user myself since 1994. If you remember the old bulletin board systems, I actually had to access through one of those dial-up bulletin boards to get any access to the internet. So now thinking, you know, where we are in the possibilities, it's just thrilling. Looking back that far to now, we never could have imagined where it would be today. And so we have before us an awesome opportunity. And of course, one of the things about, I've spent most of my career, you know, working in social services with the homeless, the addicted, I'm acutely aware of the fact that this digital divide exists out there. And so I guess both Rick Dean and myself, who would be co-founders of Connecting for Good, understand that, you know, if this is going to really impact our community, we want to make sure that everybody has a chance to benefit from it.
How do you define this idea of the digital divide?
One element of the digital divide is just not being able to connect. I mean, I think the public libraries do a wonderful job. But normally, you know, there's a long waiting period and you've only got an hour to, and you can't really get much going in an hour. Say if you want to do a resume or a job application online, you know, that your opportunities are limited. We're a Kansas corporation, nonprofit corporation, and our base is in the Rosedale area. And so we know that, you know, for years, the school district has been giving kids laptops, which they take home, but
all the kids in the school district, I don't know what grades, but certainly the high school, right?
Yes. And but when you go home and you don't have any internet access, you know, you suddenly it's not as anywhere near as effective a tool as it could be.
Yeah, it's interesting thinking about how much when I'm using my computer at home, how many of the programs I'm using involve the internet.
Well, that's just right. And if you really understand where the internet is going today, with applications all being on the cloud, I mean, pretty soon we won't have to buy a Microsoft Word for our word processor. I mean, it's all going to be hosted applications. It's ultimately going to be that unless you have bandwidth, you're just not going to be able to access some of the essential tools that our society asks of us to be proficient in. A lot of our, you know, what's prompted us to do Connecting for Good is a lot more personal on-the-ground experience. Rick, our co-founder, has family members who live right there in Rosedale who cannot connect because of the expense of it. They just don't have the budget for that. And I think that's, you know, the first element of the digital divide. The second is the fact that a lot of people, even though they may be connected, don't really understand what they can do with the internet. I mean, there's opportunities for online education. There's opportunities for getting health information. There's opportunities to connect with people around the world. You know, when you think of free bandwidth, which is what we're working on, it's not so that you can watch YouTube forever. You know, it's really so you can begin to do things that will benefit your life and improve your social, health, economic situation.
Now, part of the reason Google initially chose KCK for the fiber optic project was, as they stated, because of the potential for developing solutions to this issue of the digital divide. Do you know of other programs here locally that are working specifically on this? Or on how to make the fiber optic cable more accessible?
Well, I know there's a lot of talk so far. And I think there's a lot of great thinking going around. But I think, at least for us, you know, we're very much practical thinking guys. And we just say, what can we do right now that will make a world of difference? And so that's where the first step of trying to provide free or affordable bandwidth, you know, that's the basic thing. If you can't connect, you can't do anything with this opportunity.
Why did you think of Rosedale in the first place? And you mentioned your co-founder lives there.
Exactly. Well, I think one of the things that attracted me is the fact that it's kind of a microcosm of our whole community. I mean, our ultimate goal is to create a model that can be replicated elsewhere. You know, it is a low-income area, a very high percentage of people are minorities, recent immigrants. There's a lot of children there, but also a cross-section of the community in terms of economically. There's seniors. There are some pretty sizable public housing projects. And, of course, we know that's where a lot of the most needy people are. And so for us to wire those up, you know, is a really easily doable thing. We have the feeling that if we can do it in Rosedale, then it can be done in any of a community in our area. From our perspective, getting a wireless network up is the easy part. I mean, if we had the money, we could start construction on it today. But the question is, what do you do with it? And that's going to be the execution that's going to be much more involved. And so if we could do it with a smaller community and make it work and get the bugs out as a kind of a beta testing experience, I think that'll really help the whole community to be able to move this concept further.
And let's talk about the specifics of the plan. The first is a free wireless community network or possibly low cost.
Yeah, well, I mean, part of the issue is, you know, it's going to cost quite a bit of money to put it up, but it's also going to cost quite a bit of money to sustain it. We're going to have to hire staff. We'll have to do, maintenance and support. And so our plan is to do more of a tiered approach. It starts free, and then as you go up $10, $25, $35 is right now what we're thinking for the max. Those who can pay will contribute to the community network and keep it going.
And if people pay more, they'll get more bandwidth.
Well, that's the idea, because, of course, the bandwidth is a lot dependent upon the equipment that's in your proximity. You know, Google has announced that they would have, free nodes, that there are public buildings, there are government buildings, there are schools where they're actually going to run fiber into it at no charge. And so we would like to go to those nodes and actually broadcast the bandwidth from there. And of course, the way the whole thing works is that you start with one antenna broadcasting this way, and then it's picked up, you know, a few blocks down by another one, which would broadcast it to other nodes in the neighborhood. And so ultimately what happens is, you know, the free bandwidth will be the smallest transmitter, you might say. And then as you get into higher levels of the service, you actually may have one of those on your own home. And of course, in some ways, you know, it's for what we hope to produce, you know, up to 50 megabytes right now is going to be the cheapest internet in Kansas City. We know also that Google has applied for a patent to do gigabit wireless, which isn't out yet. But we're looking at working with a company that has told us that if, you know, when that happens, that it'll be really easy to update the equipment we were installing to handle that as well.
Now, one of the challenges I would think is that Google has not yet announced a pricing structure for the Google Fiber, and in fact, they're late on delivering it. What if they end up offering it for a very low price or on some kind of sliding scale? Would this wireless network then be necessary?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I'm not sure where the price point is going to be yet. I'm assuming that it's closer to cable. And in that case, it would be out of reach of most of the people we're talking about.
What about the e-community center that you've envisioned?
Rosedale itself doesn't have a community center of any kind at all. And so that community, you know, which is a 4-square-mile area with about 14,000 residents, has nowhere at all where they can gather. You know, the Wi-Fi is not going to get you up to the full gigabyte speed, but to have an actual center where you can plug in and experience that is really part of our plan. We've actually had some talks with the KCK Public Library System about doing a virtual branch. You know, a library with no bookshelves, where people would come in and use tablet PCs or laptops to access all the resources that are available digitally, and also to do a lending thing where they could use the tablet PCs or laptops to browse, you know, the collections and have them brought down and return them and bring them back. One of the things that we understand is that living in this digital world, community is a gigantic thing. Not just, you know, communities through Twitter, Facebook, etc., but I think also just engaging as a group in some of the things that we can benefit from as far as learning and participation. And we hope that the community center could be a magnet for entrepreneurs as well. We've talked about something we've called the launch pad. Because if we provide a place where the full-blown fiber is available, we are hoping that people will set up shop with us and begin to develop new applications right there in the needy neighborhoods. I think one of the things that I'm absolutely convinced of is that access equals opportunity.
What about partners in the neighborhood?
Wendy Wilson has actually, you know, lent a lot of leadership to Connecting for Good, and she's been a longtime executive director of the Rosedale Development Association, so they are definitely our major partner, which is really wonderful, too, because, you know, they are a very organized and well-regarded group, and it's helped us a lot to understand, you know, what we're working with, and I think will also help us to move things forward because of the relationship with the residents.
What was their reaction? I wonder, when you brought this idea to them, did they have some ideas that maybe you hadn't thought of yet?
Well, they'd actually been kicking around some of this stuff for a long time. But again, I think sometimes it's just having that, you know, the understanding of the technology, the techie part of it, a lot of people lack. And so we're techies and we bring that to our table. And for them, I think, you know, Wendy has thought for years about how do I bring this community closer together? How do I let residents know what's going on? How do we communicate, you know, all kinds of concerns in the best possible way? And so, you know, having a completely wired community is a wonderful chance to bring it together. And then if we have a physical space That's even better yet.
Michael Limata, co-founder of Connecting for Good. Thank you so much for stopping by Casey Currents.
It's been good to be with you. Thanks.
Connecting for Good is in the process of becoming a 501c3 nonprofit organization in Kansas and is just beginning to fundraise. Limata says once the Google Fiber network is up and running, they should be able to get their wireless network in Rosedale up in about 6 weeks.
Coming up, we get on the field and look at the social environment of organized sports for youth. You're listening to Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
More than 52 million youth around the country participate in organized sports, according to the National Council of Youth Sports. Many parents see it as a way for kids to get physically fit and learn teamwork and discipline. And a lot of parents like to see their kids win, too. But how important is winning? And how much pressure should parents and coaches put on young people to be the best athletes they can be?
A new study from the University of Kansas suggests that a caring sports environment is important to the psychological well-being of youth. We'll hear more from Susan about that study in a minute, but first some dispatches from Casey's sports fields. Casey Currents intern Zach Lewandowski checked out the scene at a t-ball practice in Leawood.
On a sunny afternoon at Leawood City Park, about 30 small children are gathered around a baseball diamond. The scene is somewhat chaotic as 5- and 6-year-olds try to line up in the right positions. Some enjoy play fighting in the dugout. One boy throws his hat across the infield, kicking up dust as he chases after it. The kids aren't worried about the score, they just want to enjoy themselves. It's something first-year youth t-ball coach Rick Ide stresses.
At this age group, I just want to make sure everyone has fun and at the same time learn the game, but we're not really concerned about winning. We just want everyone to have fun and be comfortable out on the field.
This emphasis on a fun environment relates to the recent research from the University of Kansas, which suggests that building caring and positive sports environments leads to increasing psychological well-being among children. It's something I'd feel strongly about.
I think it's very important. You don't want them to get down, and you want them to show up for the games and be active and run around out on the field. You don't want them just to go into a shell when they're on the field. So.
Okay, guys, remember what we learned last night? Where's first base? Where's first? Where's second? Third. Home.
Robin Fields' 5-year-old son, Jake, is enjoying his first year in sports. He played soccer this spring and is currently playing t-ball under Coach I. Fields says that her son's psychology is important for him to have a good experience with the team.
You play better when you have confidence. If someone's shattering your confidence with yelling at you and telling what you did wrong all the time, then you just do worse. Like, you need to have confidence to play sports, so that's important.
Fields says she remembers parents in high school who were overly critical with their kids during games and practices. These are people Fields refers to as the crazies. She says the parents here are all just looking out for each other's kids.
Right now it's mostly about having fun and facing the right direction and not getting hurt. So.
At this age level, the atmosphere is expected to be nothing less than fun. But as kids get older, the atmosphere changes as they become more and more competitive. For Casey Currents, I'm Zach Lewandowski.
And this is Susan. It's a sweltering day at the 3-2 Stadium just down the road from the old Bannister Mall. 3-2 is a local league promoting competitive youth baseball since 1943. All three diamonds are busy with games. On one, 9 and 10-year-old boys in professional-looking green and white uniforms are deep into it. Mike Lohman is watching his son Jake pitch. He says at this age level, the kids are beginning to combine a fun atmosphere with a competitive one.
These boys that are playing right here are 9 and 10-year-olds, and this is about the age when the coaches start getting stern with them and getting that tough voice with them and get a little tougher than, well, it's okay, you tried hard and that's good enough. Well, you know, at this age, they're starting to toughen them up a little bit, and that works well.
Coach Joe Murphy played 3-2 baseball himself when he was a kid. He's been a coach for more than 20 years.
I'm very competitive, but I also understand that they're just kids. Everybody wants to win. That's why you play the game, to win. But you also got to know that you win and lose as a team. And when you lose games, you learn lessons.
Murphy said he's seen coaches put winning over the well-being of players.
We have a couple coaches out here that are I wouldn't even consider them coaches. Coaches are supposed to be teachers as well. And some of these guys, they demoralize kids and make them not love the game. That's the key. You want to make them learn the game and love the game and take something from it as they grow older. Life lessons. That's what a coach is.
And parents aren't immune to competition either, especially as their children become older. Mike Lohman says that for the most part, parents here at 3-2 are fine. But there are times when they can ruin the experience for everyone.
They get overly zealous and they live their life through their kids, and it, you know, and they kind of take some of the niceness out of the experience.
It can be tricky to make athletics both competitive and fun, but as recent research from the University of Kansas suggests, a positive environment is crucial to a kid's development. Mary Fry is an associate professor of health, sport, and exercise science at KU. She surveyed young people about their experiences in a summer sports program and the connection to their psychological well-being. I asked her why she thought this research was necessary.
Sports is just such a critical arena for kids to have positive experiences and help them to want to be physically active. We have an epidemic here with kids that are less active and unfit and obese and overweight, and we know that physical activity is really important for kids. So this question of how we can make sport a more fun and positive experience for kids is really an important one.
Talk briefly about how you conducted this study. I mean, who participated and what was the age range of the kids that you studied and gender?
Yes, we had about 400 kids that were participating in the National Youth Sport Program. It's a national program that's at a number of universities. And we used two different sites and invited every child to complete a survey at the end of this five-week camp. They come to their respective university all day for 5 weeks and just participate in a variety of sports. They get to swim every day, and then there's a number of other enrichment activities.
So what are the major findings of your study?
Well, the major findings are that when young athletes perceive the environment on their sport camp or sport team is more caring and positive and supportive, then that in turn helps them have better handle on both their positive and their negative emotions, which in turn leads them to feel greater hope and happiness for their lives and less depression and sadness. So just greater psychological well-being.
Now, a positive environment also has another important byproduct, and that is that it's easier for kids to learn how to practice compassion and empathy. How do they learn this in a more positive environment as opposed to a negative one?
No, it seems like that a part of this is just they have good role models as coaches. And when coaches set the stage and treat kids with kindness and respect, it just seems to rub off. And we have another study showing that when the more kids perceive the environment as positive and caring, the more they engage in caring behaviors with their teammates and with their coaches. So it just seems to trickle down from the top. We also have research that shows the kids who perceive a caring environment express greater empathy for other kids.
So what kind of behaviors, if you were talking to a group of coaches, what kind of behaviors would you tell them to do more of and less of to create a better environment for kids?
I would encourage coaches to think about everything that they say and kind of reflect at the end of a practice, or even reflect as they put a practice or as they head into a competition. But the focus should be on every child's effort. So at the end, coaches should be able to say, wow, I really got excited when kids tried hard. I pointed out improvement. I gave a lot of technical instruction to help them see how they can improve. I really tried to foster cooperation in that we want kids to be supporting one another, not feel like they're competing against each other within a team. Those kind of behaviors.
Well, some critics would say, you know, look, there's too much emphasis on self-esteem, that in real life there are winners and losers, and making everybody, quote unquote, feel good doesn't really prepare kids for what the real world is like. How do you respond to this kind of criticism?
Well, there's just not, it's hard to find any research supporting that viewpoint. That having a lot of punishment, being negative, and really, you know, making it who's the biggest winner is helpful for kids. We need to really step back and look at how can we help all kids have a positive experience.
If you're too caring, if there is such a thing, does this breed kids with kind of thin skins who aren't really prepared for how tough the real world is, where people aren't always nice or fair, and work environments aren't psychologically safe?
It's a great question. I think that when we can create this caring task and involving climate, it's just important to note that it doesn't mean we've got this tea party setting where it's just, you know, everybody's great and whatever you do is fine. And hey, if you don't want to try hard, that's okay. This environment is about pushing everyone hard to be the best they can be. But when you do work hard and you give your best effort and you're trying to be the best you can be, then we should affirm that and be positive and praise kids for that. And so when kids give their very best and our reaction is, hey, you're not very good compared to others, or it's not good enough, or you should never make a mistake, or you should, you know, moan and groan every time you make a mistake, then we don't serve kids well.
Well, you know, we're talking about coaches, but then there's also the problem of parents, and they're a part of the environment because they show up at practices, and we all know about the overzealous soccer mom or the dad who's kind of living vicariously through his son who's playing sports. What do you recommend to parents? How can their behaviors be shifted so that there's a more caring and positive environment?
Yes, it's all about education, you know, for coaches and for parents. And when we can get coaches on board and they can just lay a philosophy out for parents and explain why it's so important to create this caring environment, I think most parents really come on board. You know, in the same way coaches have good intentions, most parents do too. There's a lot of great material out there for both coaches and parents to help them think about the things they say and the behaviors they engage in, and you know, just reflect on how they can make it a more positive experience for their kids.
You're listening to Casey Currents. We're talking to Dr. Mary Fry about research on the importance of caring environments when children participate in sports. You mentioned in your article about the importance of quality adult leadership in sports programs. Now, if you're a parent on the outside looking in, how do parents know that there's quality adult leadership?
They don't know without really checking out programs and asking questions and observing. And so I feel strongly that parents need to be very proactive and check out programs well before they enroll their kids. They should inquire as to the league director what kind of coaching education is required or available for coaches, what are the policies, kind of what's the philosophy of the program. And they really want to look for a program where the focus is on every kid's development.
So, of course, this is a scholarly endeavor, a scholarly article, but what are the main takeaway points that you hope that the lay public takes away from this kind of research?
Well, I hope that that coaches can hear this research and just have it translated in simple terms, but just to remind them what an important role they play for young athletes. So they have the potential to help young people have fun, you know, try hard, develop skills, have a great social experience and make friends, and also on the bigger picture to develop greater psychological well-being. And so it's just a huge role. Our psychological well-being is influenced by so many things besides our sport experience. And so that's where it's neat to see that the sport experience is huge, because it impacts things on the bigger picture level. And for parents, I hope this could just be a prompt to them to really check out the teams and the programs that their kids are involved with. We need more parents just being proactive and, you know, really encouraging leagues and programs to take this research seriously, to have great coaching education as, you know, as part of what they deliver for coaches.
Mary Fry teaches sport and exercise psychology at the University of Kansas. Find a link to her research on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
If you can't listen to all of KC Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
One of Kansas City's main domestic violence agencies opened a new shelter this month, but not for women. Rose Brooks now has an on-site pet shelter, making it the first agency in the region and one of just a few dozen nationwide to have a place for domestic violence victims' pets. As KCUR's Alana Gordon reports, for some women, the new resource may mean the difference between seeking safety and continuing to live in danger.
Imagine a small pony. That's about the size of Hank.
4'2" from his head to the ground.
A 150-pound, all-black,
lovable,
Great Dane.
He is my baby in every sense of the word. He is my everything.
That's Mackenzie. Well, Mackenzie's not her real name.
It protects me from my abuser and protects confidentiality for my safety.
The same goes for Hank. I meet the two of them at Rose Brooks, a domestic violence shelter in Kansas City. It's a place they've been to before. Not too long ago, Mackenzie said she was in trouble and didn't see it coming.
You know, there's signs to abuse. They'll start to call you names and they'll start to isolate you from your family. And I didn't get any of that.
But 3 months into her relationship, and less than a month after she and her boyfriend moved in together, everything changed. In a moment.
If Hank hadn't been there, I would not be here.
One day, her boyfriend snapped.
He put me through the nearest wall, and I went through the wall. You don't feel anything. You don't.
He proceeded to beat her. Well, he tried to. Hank, 100 pounds at the time, laid on top of her and shielded her.
And hammer did not hit me in my ribs. A roofing hammer did not hit me in my ribs. He laid on top of me, and I was not hit in the head. He laid on top of me, and my hips were not broken. He endured everything so that I would not.
Mackenzie managed to escape. She later returned with police when her boyfriend wasn't home and found Hank bruised and unable to walk. Police then brought them to Rose Brooks. There was just one problem. The shelter, like others, didn't take pets.
We wish that we could have taken dogs for the last 30 years of being here. But when it came down to it, we just didn't have the resources, we didn't have the time, we didn't have the staff.
Sarah North is with the shelter. She says an improved police referral system and a down economy, which can make domestic violence situations worse, had the shelter focused on an increase in women and children who were turning to them for help.
Getting into pets is a whole different world than what we do.
I said, I have to have him. We have to be together. I'm not ever going to leave him.
Mackenzie was serious, so she told a staff member,
I'm going to go to a rest stop. We're just going to go on ahead and get out of town. And she said, you're going to a rest stop? I said, well, yeah, you don't take dogs. I'm leaving. And she said, no, you can't leave. Your life is in danger. I said, oh, yeah. I mean, you know, that's fine. But we're going to leave. And she said, well, let me make some phone calls.
The shelter made an exception for them. Hank stayed in an unused handicapped bathroom in the basement. As his health improved, he started making his way around the shelter.
People who aren't dog people became dog people. Everyone here loved him back together.
Again, Sarah North.
When Mackenzie was referring to people who aren't really dog people who love Hank, she was referring to me.
North says it took some adjusting at the shelter. Hank's big. Not everyone was comfortable with him, but overall, it was good having him there.
immediately we saw the therapeutic benefit not only to her, but to the other residents and even to the staff.
Allie Phillips is director of the National Center for the Prosecution of Animal Abuse. She says across the country, things don't always turn out the way they did for Mackenzie.
There are women who will just simply not come forward and report the abuse or go to a shelter because they know their local shelter will not take their pet.
Phillips says this happens all the time, especially because pets and livestock can be effective targets by abusers who want to control their victims.
What a better way to get silence and compliance from an adult or child victim than to say, if you tell anybody or if you struggle, I'm going to kill the dog or I'm going to kill the cat. And it is that power of targeting the pet that maintains the power of terror and abuse by the abuser over their victims.
Phillips, who now helps domestic violence shelters set up programs for victims' pets, says out of the more than 2,500 shelters across the country, she's aware of about 70 that now have some sort of option for pets. Rose Brooks recently joined that list.
Thank you all so much for being here today, and we're so lucky we have great weather.
Susan Miller, the shelter's director, recently announced the opening of Paw's Place. It's a barn-like structure with room for 8 pets.
At 3 o'clock this afternoon, all of our kennels will be full. So I'm just so happy.
What happened was, after the shelter made an exception for Mackenzie and Hank, they started taking in some other victims' pets. Staff got in touch with area animal organizations for backup support. Then, when the shelter started moving forward with a big expansion of its family wing, they decided to add on plans for this on-site pet shelter. The project garnered support from pet people across the country. As for Mackenzie, she's thrilled.
It's a great honor to know that out of pain can come triumph for not just me.
And that what was a horrific, terrible experience for her and Hank now means other women will face less barriers in seeking safety. Reporting for Casey Currents, I'm Alana Gordon.
For more information and resources on domestic violence, you can visit our website, kcur.org.
After the break, area actors alternate day to day between comedy and tragedy. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, staff of North Kansas City Hospital were shocked to hear it might be sold. The budget for Missouri higher education was cut again, and the Kansas City streetcar project suffered a setback. Steve Bell recaps those and other top stories of the week on the KCUR Weekend News Review.
Mayor Sly James said the city would not give up on the proposed downtown streetcar system, despite the rejection of its request for $25 million in federal money for the project. Federal transportation officials said they liked the plan, but will wait till there's a tax in place to finance the city's part. The staff and administration of North Kansas City Hospital were shocked to learn that the city has it up for sale, and Dr. Mike Montgomery, chair of its board, said they'll fight any decision to sell.
We don't want to be sold, so we're looking into what we can do to try and prevent ourselves from being sold.
One legal question is whether the city actually owns the hospital or if it's owned by the nonprofit corporation that operates it. The Kansas Board of Regents announced that starting in 4 years, the standards for automatic admission to KU will be a B average, not the C grades now sufficient at all state colleges and universities. Tyler Rockers is the president of the KU Student Alumni Leadership Board.
It does cement KU's position as the flagship institution of the state of Kansas.
The Regents also approved tuition increases of from 3% to 6% at 6 public universities and 1 for the KU Med School. The Kansas election process settled down as the State Objections Board upheld Secretary of State Chris Kobach's authority to reassign more than 80 candidates to run in new redrawn districts. Lieutenant Governor Jeff Collier is on the board.
If we would follow a different policy, that it would certainly put the elections at risk. It would potentially throw dozens of candidates off of the ballot.
The objections board also upheld Coster's denying Lake Quivira Democrat Larry Meeker a place on the ballot for the Kansas House in a dispute over whether his paperwork was lost or never filed. In things that didn't run so smoothly in Kansas, court hearings on a school funding lawsuit by 54 districts entered its third week, and more than 200 people showed up to protest Governor Sam Brownback's plan to privatize the Medicaid system.
Why is this administration so willing to trust, without empirical data, these supposed savings? Why do we think that this is going to provide enough revenue to take care of our population? It just seems ridiculous, and trust does not exist in this process for me.
Testified Chris Ealing, parent of a child with disabilities. Wednesday was the last day for public comments. Wrapping up the week, Governor Jay Nixon did some pruning on the Missouri budget for the coming year. He started off with $15 million in cuts, $9 million of which will come from the state's colleges and universities. The Kansas Board of Healing Arts revoked the license of Dr. Ann Kristen Newhouse over second opinion psychiatric exams of young patients of murdered abortion provider George Tiller. The board said her records didn't prove she gave thorough exams. This is KCUR.
This year's Heart of America Shakespeare Festival is going back and forth between comedy and tragedy on alternate nights. They're returning to a two-show season performed in repertory, which hasn't been done in a decade. For the cast and crew alike, there's a delicate balance to doing a different show every other night, as KCUR's Steve Walker reports.
Just west of the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art on a 90-degree day, actors and tech people are gathering in Southmoreland Park to rehearse Antony and Cleopatra. One of two shows, the other is A Midsummer Night's Dream, that Heart of America Shakespeare Festival is staging this summer. One can hear birds chirping, leaves rustling, and the occasional siren, plus hammers banging their final touches upon the double-sided set, so designed because the shows are being done in repertory, where, say, a Tuesday performance of Midsummer is followed on Wednesday by Antony. Canopied from the sun are five cast members and the festival's artistic director, Sydney Garrett, who explains the appeal of doing two shows in this, their 20th anniversary year.
Our hope is that for our 20th year, it's a huge year. You know, it's great to have reached the ripe old age of 20 years old for this festival. Mm-hmm. And to be telling two extremely different stories. If you see the set for this play and the costumes and the story, overall story, extremely different than when the set rotates and the fairy costumes come out. I mean, it's, you know, they're completely different looks, completely different feel. You know, I think it's a great combination for this big year for us.
Actors Kim Martin Cotton and John Rensenhouse, who play Cleopatra and Antony respectively in that play and other roles in the comedy, say they embrace the opportunity to play in repertory while acknowledging the challenges.
I love rep because when someone has a big role in one and a smaller role in the other, then you get a night to rejuvenate and be back with lots of energy the next night.
One day I will focus on one character, and the next day I will focus on the other character. And the one character, Antony, is, you know, a soldier at the heart of a tragic love story, and Oberon, the other character, is casting spells on people. So it's a much more sense of fun and lighthearted thing. And because once I sink my thoughts into the world of Antony, you need to stay there for a while. Can't flip back and forth that easily.
Playing Bottom in Midsummer in The Soothsayer in Antony is Jan Rogge, who says, and Rensenhouse echoes, that it's highly unlikely repertory actors could forget what show they're in on any given night.
You're in the world of it. You've got your costumes and your wigs and you see everybody else, and there's such a different energy, don't you think, of Antony and Cleopatra in Midsummer?
There's a good analogy that if you stepped onto a basketball court, you wouldn't think about playing football. So when you're in the set and in the clothes, you don't get confused.
Still, actors can be superstitious and should take note of Bruce Roach's experience doing Shakespeare in rep in Oslo.
I was all geared up to go to the pool and spend a couple of hours at my apartment complex in the afternoon and relax for that night's show. And I got a call from stage management, and she said, why aren't you in the wig room right now? I said, well, I'm getting ready to go to the pool. She said, well, aren't you going to do Orsino this afternoon? I said, no, that's tonight. And that was before Cell phones were prevalent, of course. I wouldn't have had a phone with me at the poolside. And there are those hazards.
When asked if they had a favorite of their two roles, most of the actors laughed, but Bruce Roach has actually given it some thought.
The role that you think is the hardest is the one that you end up liking better because you have to give more attention to it. It's like the troubled child requires more attention. And so the role that scares you the most, perhaps, is the one that you end up having the greatest attraction or attachment to.
Though the actors are modest about learning lines for two plays simultaneously, they all give kudos to the backstage crew, who at the close of one performance switch out all the props and physically turn the set completely around. Steve Walker, KCUR News.
One of Kansas City's musical greats has just made another leap in his quest for international acclaim. Pianist Behzad Abdurrahmov first earned worldwide recognition when he won the 2009 London International Competition. And now, at the age of 21, he's just released his debut CD on Decca. It's music by Camille Saint-Saëns, Franz Liszt, and Sergei Prokofiev. We're listening to Prokofiev's Suggestion Diabolique. Behzad Abdurrahmov was born in 1990, and he began studying music with Stanislav Judenich at Park University in 2007. The two men have more than the piano in common, though. In 2010, Judenich told Alex Smith about their shared background in the capital of Uzbekistan, Tashkent.
We are from the same school, right? And he was studying with a lady who was one of the greatest teachers for kids, all right? I didn't study with her. I studied with the rival lady. Okay, but both of them were fantastic. And in this situation, we sort of have a great peace between these two. Mm-hmm. Okay, Behzad is my student, and so we have a good ending of the story.
Abdurrahmov's new album has won rave reviews from critics in the U.S. and the U.K. One called his technique more than a little startling, but his performance has also been called subtle and refined. We're going to end today's KC Currents hearing another track, Abdurrahmov's recording of Franz Liszt's Harmonie Poétique and Religieuse, Poetic and Religious Harmonies.
Thank you.
We thank you for tuning into KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast. You can find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia with assistant producers Alex Smith and Suzanne Hogan. Our intern is Zach Lewandowski, and theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.